Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
But dude averages 18 yards after catch.
We get it. When you're passionate about something, you go all in. You live entirely in that world. That's exactly how Graybar is about renewable energy projects.
He's all fourth quarter, such a
sleeper. Join our league of clean energy at Graybar.com. Yep, Graybar does that.
The search for truth never ends. Introducing June's Journey, a hidden object mobile game with a captivating story. Connect with friends, explore the roaring 20s, and enjoy thrilling activities and challenges while supporting environmental causes. After 7 years, the adventure continues with our immersive travels feature. Explore distant cultures and engage in exciting experiences. There's always something new to discover. Are you ready? Download June's Journey now on Android or iOS.
Welcome back, folks. We are trying to connect up to Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness for the city in New Orleans. We intend to discuss the public safety preparations ahead of the Super Bowl. And as soon as we connect up with him, we'll get him on the air. I did want to say that our thoughts and prayers go out to the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office. One of the canines this morning, after apprehending a suspect, was killed. In case you didn't know this, I mean, canines are protected just like officers in many aspects under the law. They play a vital role in extensive training, and a lot of what is done by law enforcement without the utilization of canine dogs would not otherwise be possible. They are such an incredibly important tool to the safety and security of the men and women in law enforcement. Every time we lose a canine in the line of duty, it is heart-wrenching. And so our thoughts and prayers go out. They were actually successfully able to apprehend the suspect in the 2000 block of Esthelot Avenue in Harvey. The JPSO was assisting the U.S. Marshals Service Task Force, and you know how I feel about them. I've talked about that organization and the incredible work that they do each and every day. So our thoughts and prayers go out. They have not identified the canine as of yet, our thoughts and prayers go out to the organization. We're joined by Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness for the City of New Orleans. Colin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Colin, we're going to talk about preparations for Super Bowl, obviously. I wanted to start, though, with this SEER Level 1. Obviously, in the aftermath of the terrorist event on Bourbon Street, there's been a lot of discussion about SEER Level 1. The Super Bowl's been a SEER Level 1 event for a long, long time. This year, obviously, Mardi Gras is as well. And I know that you've coordinated with federal authorities for a number of years. If you would, for the benefit of listening audience, kind of describe, you know, what that actually means from a city's perspective.
Sure. So every year, the Department of Homeland Security in Washington, D.C. has an office that evaluates all special events in the country. And so usually during August, we have an all call where we enter in all of our special events into a matrix, and they're all adjudicated by the Department of Homeland Security based on a number of factors, you know, whether it's an outdoor festival, whether there's an attendance fee, whether there's how many are anticipated to attend, you know. So there's hundreds of, you know, probably 200,000 special events nationwide that they evaluate around the country, and they rank them in what they call a SEER rating, which is a special event assessment rating. And they rate them from one being the most high profile to five being, you know, essentially, I wouldn't say least, but most local type event, you know. And so, you know, by and large, most of these, you know, hundreds of thousands of events are SEER 3 through 5. But there's a select handful every year. And really, when you look at the numbers, it's pretty staggering. It's, you know, less than probably 20 to 25 a year are SEER 2 and SEER 1. And so you typically, the Super Bowl is always a SEER 1. It's a huge event, and you know about it 2 to 3 years out when you're announced as a city that you're getting it. And then the planning in earnest starts about a year and a half before the actual game, 2 years really, because we go as visiting public safety and go and visit the other cities where the Super Bowl is going to be and look at their preparations. We basically shadow them. And then we are doing the same this year with both the Bay Area and Los Angeles. Inglewood are coming this year to our Super Bowl to shadow us. And so it's a pretty unique process. It's pretty much guaranteed. What the SEER 2 and SEER, there's a huge jump between SEER 3 and SEER 2, and then a greater jump to SEER 1. But I think the biggest distinction is between SEER 3 and SEER 2. SEER 3 through 5 get essentially no dedicated federal assistance. Now, we have a lot of SEER 3 through 5 events in the city. We have, you know, hundreds of special events a year that are designated as SEER 3. And so we can call our local federal counterparts here in the city, the Coast Guard, HSI, the FBI, and they will give us support to the extent that they can based on, you know, their availability. But we've never been denied any of that. The Coast Guard will always put a boat on the river for us extra if there's something going on down at the park. You know, we'll always get that type of intelligence and buy-in. What distinguishes a SEER 1 and SEER 2 is that it's mandated federal support. So a federal coordinating team is assigned to the event, and that's typically 3 to 4 senior level, most of the time law enforcement agents. You know, typically the special agent in charge of one of our, you know, as an example, the Homeland Security Investigations is the federal coordinating, lead federal coordinator for a Super Bowl, and I believe now for Mardi Gras as well, since it was amped up. They bring a team together, and we sit down, and we plan out what type of assets and resources we think we might need. These can be anything from, you know, physical security assets to a lot of times it's personnel as far as tactical teams. The federal government has quite a few of those in their arsenal. Vehicles. It can be intelligence sharing. That's pretty much an automatic one. Cyber, we're seeing a lot more of. Drone detection and mitigation, which is something unique to the federal government. Just a lot of different resources that they can bring down and bring to the city for these designated major special events.
Colin, of the SEER Level 1 events thus far, has there been any similar in nature to Mardi Gras?
No. And as a matter of fact, you know, we fought pretty hard, and I'll give credit to Mayor Cantrell, because it started with Mayor Cantrell and my predecessor, Colonel Terry Ebert, who really kept going back to DHS and saying, listen, I don't think you fully grasp or understand what Mardi Gras is. For years, they considered Mardi Gras one day, just Fat Tuesday. And they weren't looking at the entire, 10 to 12 days, and it's even more, but what we consider the 33 float parades, the major days of parading, as what we consider Carnival or Mardi Gras. And we finally got them to understand it. And what we did was we took pictures of the crowds from the Coast Guard helicopter in 2018, and it changed their minds rather quickly. And so from 2019 till now, minus the years of COVID without Mardi Gras, we have had a SEER 2 support from the federal government for the 5 days leading up to Fat Tuesday. So from that Wednesday of parading through the weekend with Endymion and Tux and those big parades all the way through Rex Zulu and the truck parades, that they considered that Mardi Gras. So we had a win there for several years of that 5 days of SEER 2 support. Now this year, it's not only upgraded to a SEER 1 instead of a SEER 2, but they're also including the first Friday, Saturday, and Sunday parades as well, starting with Allah.
So correct me if I'm wrong, based on my experience, that this federal coordinating teams that are assigned.
Sorry, OSHA. A lot of.
I'm sorry.
I was looking at my, sorry, OSHA. That's the first parade, major parade.
My experience has been that a lot of what the federal coordinating teams are doing are sitting at a round table with you, going through some of the requests and deficiencies that, and I shouldn't say deficiencies, but some of the needs. There's like a security assessment, needs assessment that's done, and there are asks made of local government to the federal government. And then in return, there's a response as to whether or not there's a willingness for them to be able to provide those assets or resources necessary. Would that be a fair characterization of the process?
Yeah, that's fair. You know, obviously they're out with us on the ground during the actual event as well, you know, in the various command posts and things like that. But really it starts with that planning process and really just identifying gaps. If there's a gap in what you need and versus what you have on hand, you know, the whole idea of incident command system, and it's an expanding incident where you've gone beyond the ability of local, you know, resources and capabilities to handle it. So, you know, the state is a partner in this as well, but this is one of those things where the federal government will just come in and say, listen, what do you need? And we don't get everything we ask for. Some things maybe don't exactly exist the way we think they do. And mm-hmm. then some things are just not possible to bring in. But for the most part, what we ask for is typically what is given.
Right. So let me, and the reason I ask this question is that there are a lot of talking heads going on right now, and I know you're in a difficult position. If you can't answer this, that's okay. I mean, I know there's a number of investigations going on, and I didn't want to put you on the spot about a whole lot because it wouldn't be fair to you. But you know, there's a lot of talk about like there's could be this potential major overhaul reengineering of Mardi Gras, and again, based on my experience, I don't think that's the role that they play, and I would doubt very seriously that, especially this Mardi Gras, that they have the human capital oomph, the intelligence oomph, and everything else to really bring that type of situation about. Your thoughts?
I'm glad you asked. We've had a lot of discussion about this, and it's there have been difficult discussions, but really everyone is of the same mind, and I think that I feel comfortable speaking for, you know, this administration right now at this point. There are things that we can do for Carnival that will make a difference, particularly in the French Quarter, as we've seen. I think it's necessary, and I think a lot of the things that you're seeing going on down in the French Quarter right now, I would ask people to be patient. They're testing out a lot of different things right now. Some of these things I think will be temporary. Some may end up being more of a permanent fixture in how we secure particularly Bourbon Street and the surrounds around Bourbon Street and potentially Jackson Square and potentially Frenchman. Now we're looking at very, very strongly. We've also asked our federal partners, and Commissioner Bratton is more doing a holistic kind of view of special events, I think, and how we do them. But we're asking them to look at the parade routes as well. But we're having the focus for right now, because Super Bowl is imminent, just making sure that we're good to go in the French Quarter in particular. So a lot of these things, you'll see different types of barricades out there. You may see them now. A lot of these are being tested. A lot of them are kind of we're seeing what works for the NOPD. But to your question directly, I don't think there's a whole lot that we're going to change about Mardi Gras, because I don't think the public wants that. You know, I think that we have a unique culture and a very unique event that nobody else really has. And I know that everyone that I have talked to in at every level, federal, state, and local, has said that they don't want to be the person that destroys that or changes that in such a way that it's not the same as what we've had before. So I think there will be some upgrades in security. Some things you might not even see. Some things you probably will see. I think there'll be better protection of some of the intersections and streets along the parade routes. You know, but as far as any drastic changes to Mardi Gras, I know there's a lot of stuff going on out there right now, or information that's being passed around. I would say, you know, stand by on that, because, you know, I know for a fact that our federal coordinator is asked to meet with the crews directly just to address this.
Yeah, I mean, because there is a limitation on these assets and resources. When you have kind of like the Super Bowl and it's site-specific, that's where their particular expertise is. It really is.
That's
right?
Correct.
And look, that's what they do in D.C. for all their functions up there. You know what's coming up on January 20th, and you know the whole nine yards. I mean, that's where their expertise is. When you spread out a six mile parade route with you know, a million plus people on it, that's a whole different game. That one, I don't think that they've ever played before. I mean, like, and that's not a criticism. I mean, it's just that it's not their, that's not their expertise. And I think it's fair to say that.
I think that's fair, and I think that even you know, the teams that have come in, they realize that, you know, even on that Saturday we have three parade routes in the city, one on the West Bank, and two, as you mentioned, 5 miles long, going basically. Cutting the city into quarters, you know, and making it, you know, a very difficult thing to protect completely. I guess the idea of wrapping the entire city in bubble wrap is just not going to work. It's not going to happen.
Or barricades.
Nor barricades. Yeah.
I
think there's a risk that is assumed when you're in large crowds like that, that the public understands. It's the same thing with, you know, this terrorist used rolling coolers. I mean, how many of those are on the parade route? Are we going to try and say that nobody can bring a cooler to a parade? I just don't think that's going to work.
I want to meet that person that says that.
I don't think they'll step out and say that. I think they'll offer us some very common sense recommendations that we will seriously look at, and many we will implement. But some of the things that, you know, that I've been hearing kind of just through the, you know, through some of the media and kind of through the grapevine, I guess, are just, you know, it's just we're not there at this point.
So part of so let's just focus real quick here on the Super Bowl. I mean, part of the SEER 1 level 1 process is that, you know, you begin, it's like a series of concentric circles, you know, getting more and more restrictive as you get closer and closer to the event. And already there are some closures of certain, you know, places around the dome at the present time, and they're already into that series of concentric circles, right?
They are, and as the time goes on over the next 3 weeks, you'll begin to see that get tighter and tighter. I'd like the public to understand that the planning for Super Bowl is extensive, and it involves from the get-go the federal and state and local authorities, and the plans for around the Superdome complex, just because of the game, don't have to be changed, if at all. They lock that down extremely tight. And we've had 11, this is our 11th Super Bowl, so we've all experienced that before. I think what we'll be looking at is the pedestrian travel on Poydras from the game to the French Quarter, protecting that like you saw happen for Sugar Bowl this year, and then obviously an enhanced, much enhanced physical security measures in the French Quarter and particularly around Bourbon Street.
And what makes it interesting too,
I'd add also the convention center. You know, we're working with them right now. They have the NFL experience, and we want to make sure that that's ready to go as well.
But if you look around the NFL, just as it relates as to how the stadiums present themselves, New Orleans is one of the few cities that literally from hotel rooms that you can walk to the stadium.
It's amazing. Yeah.
I think Minneapolis is like that. And I'm just thinking off the top of my head, there are not many others. Tennessee has that situation.
Indianapolis is like that, but unfortunately, a lot of their hotels are out of town. You have to go get further and further out with hotels. When we went to Arizona for their Super Bowl, you had 20 and 30 municipalities that were all involved in the Super Bowl planning. It was 40-minute drive from Phoenix to the stadium. It was a massive footprint. You know, it just and L.A. Can tend to be the same way now, too. The stadium, I believe, is in Inglewood. And so we do have a very unique situation here in New Orleans, where this is a very pedestrian friendly or walkable city. And that enhances the challenges that we face.
And that was the point I wanted to get to. Actually, it makes it harder, easier. Colin, as always, we really appreciate your time, your insight. Thank you so much for joining us today. I know you're busy.
Sir.
Best of luck to you as we ramp up to the Super Bowl.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All righty, folks. That was Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness for the City of New Orleans. When we come back, we'll visit with Michael Glasser, President of PANO. We'll talk about the latest on the consent decree. Stay with us.
Wow. What's up? I just bought and financed a car through Carvana in minutes.
You? The person who agonized 4 weeks over whether to paint your walls eggshell or off-white bought and financed a car in minutes?
They made it easy. Transparent terms, customizable down and monthly. Didn't even have to do any paperwork.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Hey, have you checked out that spreadsheet I sent you for our dinner options?
Finance your car with Carvana and experience total control. Financing subject to credit approval.
Head to Safeway this week for these amazing deals for their members. USDA Choice Boneless Beef Tri-Tip Roast, Untrimmed Twin Pack, just $4.99 per pound. Signature Farms Boneless Skinless Chicken Breasts, Thighs or Wings. Buy one, get one free of equal or lesser value when you buy two. Progresso Soup, 18 to 19 ounce selected varieties. Buy two, get four free when you buy six. Visit Safeway.com for more details. See you in the aisles.
Do you believe you are wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, the Night Stalker. These names are infamous, but do you really know what drove them to kill?
In Mind of a Serial Killer, we don't just tell you the story. We break down the psychology behind it.
Follow and listen to Mind of a Serial Killer, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Crime House Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Michael Glasser, president of the Policemen's Association of New Orleans. Mike, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Newell. Thank you.
So, Michael, let me make sure, because I said containment instead of sustainment yesterday, so I want to make sure I get this right. Moving to the next phase of this consent decree, the sustainment period granted by Judge Susie Morgan yesterday, when I did not realize this until this morning, that some of the federal monitors were suggesting otherwise, but I think it's the appropriate move at this time. Your thoughts?
Oh, I think it's more than appropriate. You know, we've moving into the 13th year of a 6-year consent decree. So, yeah, I think it's more than past time and overdue, as a matter of fact.
What were the objections of the monitors? They were saying what? Do you know?
Well, there was some earlier this in 2024, there was some a little what they call backsliding of some issues. And this is due to their oversight. And this is something, by the way, Newell, let me mention it this way. The consent decree itself and our ability to perform and comply with it does not change. Okay, the rules are the rules. We're going to keep doing the exact same thing. Nothing is going to change except the actual oversight. Instead of looking at it continuously multiple times a day for every single thing, it'll move into a periodic issue. They'll be looked at periodically. They'll be looked at quarterly. They'll be looked at as a need arises if a particular incident comes up, and they'll be spot checked. But the oversight is what's going to be reduced. And some of the monitors felt that they needed to continue doing this for some of the backsliding, but we've managed to make improvements in those areas, and the judge was convinced that we're at a position where that oversight can be reduced at this point.
I guess it's fair to characterize it this way. The pressure's on, right? You control your own destiny now as an organization, and you have to prove every day that you're able to do so.
Well, we had to prove it every day and every call. That's the whole point of right. What was objectionable about the consent decree. It wasn't the new rules and the new way of doing things. It was the constant oversight. You know, I kind of likened it to every time you get in your car, having to check your tire pressure, check the oil, check the power steering fluid, check the transmission fluid. You don't do that every time you get in and out of the car. You can do it periodically. You can do it when it looks low. You can do it when the time is up and it expires. You can do it, but you don't have to do it every time you get in and out of the car. And that's what we were doing with the consent decree. We were looking at every call, every time, every day. The oversight was just crushing. And now we won't have to do that as often. But the rules, the way we operate, are now embedded in the rules, and that's the way we do it.
What is the reaction of the rank and file been?
Well, they're looking forward to this. Like I said, it's an enormous burden on the supervision, on the front line sergeants, the mid-level lieutenants, and, of course, on the captains as well, and on the bureau that we have, professional standards and accountability. They still have a big job to do to make sure that these things get done, but they don't have the constant federal oversight, and that's the point. It is a relaxation on just what we have to do on a daily basis, but again, we don't do anything differently. We just don't have the oversight.
You know, it's funny. A lot of these consent decrees, they don't go away. I mean, you know, we're entering, as you said, the 13th year. I think there's some that have been on again, off again, on again, and it seems like they never get out of this kind of circular thing with DOJ.
Well, we'll not get out of the consent decree. Per se. I mean, the monitoring, but the consent decree is now embedded in our department regulations. So the consent decree and the regulations are identical. We have to do that now. And what a lot of people don't realize, and some of the people who are concerned about us going into this sustainment period and concerned about the going forward with the consent decree, this is 12 years. That means that everybody that's hired in the last 12, almost 13 years has never seen this department not in a consent decree. They don't know any other way of doing policing except what the consent decree says to do. And this is a very young department for the most part because we have such a high turnover. So most of this department has never seen the department that didn't have a consent decree, and now it's in the rules. So this is the way we're going to operate going forward, whether there's federal oversight or not.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what the percentage is. I got to imagine that, like you said, it's pretty high. And basically what you're saying, the long and short of it, is the culture's been developed, it's embedded, and it is what it is.
Right. It's literally half a generation at this point, okay, that this department has turned over, and people here, the overwhelming majority of the department, has never seen anything different. So there's nothing to backslide to because there's nobody to backslide it with. You know, it's all people
they don't
that
know
have been
any
hired
the way.
And are working have,
there's no
have
muscle.
Never seen a different way.
The only muscle memory is the consent decree way, right, for the lion's share of
it.
Folks within the organization.
Right. So it's not a matter of trying to reconcile our rules with the consent decree. The rules are the consent decree. That's all those 400-plus paragraphs are now embedded into our department regulations, and that's what they learn when they're in the academy, and that's what we work with day by day.
So let's pivot from the outside looking in to the inside looking at the inside. Is there something internally that the department intends to do, to your knowledge, relative to this sustainment period?
Well, I believe we're going to revise our disciplinary system somewhat. Again, things that are against the rules are still against the rules, but there is a very, very high administrative burden in addressing those things, and I think they're looking to streamline that down so that it's just easier, faster, and quicker. That we have cases that have gone on for years, which is ridiculous. If
That's
there is
tragic.
An allegation of right, there's an allegation of misconduct, it should be addressed immediately. Number one, if there is misconduct, we want to correct it and eliminate it and correct it going forward. And if there isn't any, then we want to return that officer to where they belong and handle it that way. Either way, dragging it out for years is not the answer, and that's unfortunately what's happened. And part of that has to do with the fact that, A, we're understaffed, and B, the administrative burden is so high. So the staffing we're always working on, but the administrative burden will now be reduced somewhat. I think they're going to streamline it. There's some plans to do that, and it falls within the acceptance of the monitors in the court. So going forward, I think we're going to see a better plan.
The and I was just curious whether there, because y'all have kind of your own monitors internal, right, that you've had through this process.
We do. We have a Public Integrity Bureau, which, of course, does the actual investigation of allegations of misconduct. And we have what's called PSAB, which is Professional Standards and Accountability. And they're like we used to call them compliance. It's just a fancier name at this point. But they're basically compliance. What they do is they make sure that the department is operating the way it's supposed to. And there's constant audits, constant oversight from them. Not so much the monitors now, but it will be for them, and their job will remain the same.
Yeah, and they kind of worked hand in glove with the federal monitors historically, right?
They do. They report back to the monitors and what we are doing and what we've done. If there's anything to be corrected, they indicate what's been done for that to their satisfaction. So, yes, that will continue.
To the best of your knowledge, you may not have access to this information. I'm not certain. I mean, some of it's been publicly reported. But I got to imagine that moving to the sustainment period also saves the NOPD a lot of money, because all of that federal oversight you guys were actually paying for, right?
And I can tell you it was hideously expensive. Yes, that is correct. And it will save the city a ton of money. And not to mention all the advantages we just talked about, but yes, it was hideously expensive, and that will be reduced as well.
Let's pivot, if you don't mind, to the terrorist attack on Bourbon Street. Just always concerned about the psyche of the men and women of the NOPD. What are you hearing?
Well, it's kind of a broad question. Maybe we could narrow it down a little bit, and I can focus on something.
You know what I mean. I mean, you get the anecdotal stories of, you know, I'm told that the scene was horrific, and, you know, and you go through a lot of years of service, and I think you've served 40 years or somewhere around there with the NOPD. I'm told by some folks that in their 30 years of police service, they've never seen a scene as horrific as that. And obviously that has some downstream implications to the department.
It does. And working on that question, yes. You know, we've all seen, with any degree of police service, we've all seen fatality accidents and serious accidents where people are injured. In some cases, it's unfortunately rather gruesome. In this case, you have 15 people, or 14 at least, in a three-block radius, and it was not pretty. So there's a lot of PTSD that we're trying to ward off and head off, and there's a lot of effort being given to bringing in people to discuss this and give people an opportunity to talk to counselors and therapists, psychologists, and officer assistance program to help work them through it, because a lot of these cops are new. Some of these cops are brand new, and they haven't seen any of those things, truthfully. And even the ones that are veterans haven't seen anything quite like this. This was unusual. So they are doing something on that. It's in full swing. We have people going to that now, and the department's taking some big steps in that.
That's good to hear. I mean, I my own personal experience, I don't mean I'm tooting my horn, but when I worked Pan Am Flight 759, the same kind of horrific crime scene to this day, you know, all these years later, 30-something years later, I remember it like it was yesterday.
You know, I was there for that too, so I remember it well.
You know, it's amazing how you can recall the horrific nature of that, you know, and it's like this 8mm video that just keeps going around and around and around, you know, it never ends. And you when you think about it, like just now when I mentioned it, there are visions of it that I recall, like I'm standing there in Kenner looking at it today. And I mean, and a lot of folks don't realize it's much the same thing with police shootings. You know, you get these folks say, well, there's another notch in the belt. That's not how this works. You know, I mean, it's not how it works at all.
There are some things in memory that are pretty much indelible. And this is one of those things.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that they have this support system set up for those guys and women that were on that scene. And obviously we appreciate same. And thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it and have a great weekend.
You too, Noel. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Michael Glasser, president of the Policemen Association of New Orleans. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed today's show. We covered a lot of territory, and a lot of it having to do with the ramp up to the Super Bowl. You know, the Super Bowl is one of those dynamic, transformational events, and it's not just here. I mean, in almost every city in every city that hosts the Super Bowl, there are transformational things that go on. And it's one of the reasons, just one of many, obviously, that folks love to lure a Super Bowl to their city, because they recognize what it can actually mean to the city. There's going to be so much free press for us and highlighted in so many different ways, and we are a tourism and hospitality city. It probably means more to us than some, not most, but some, that don't rely on tourism as much as we do. And, you know, putting that best foot forward and prettying up our city and putting lipstick in areas that we haven't had lipstick is incredibly important. I get a lot of texts of people like, why, you know, are we so focused on this? It's for that very reason, because the return for us to maximize the leverage is to put our best foot forward in so many different ways. And we had that lengthy conversation with both Michael Heck and Joe Threat Sr., the Deputy Chief Administrative Officer of Infrastructure and Chief Resilience Officer of the City of New Orleans. I don't know about you. That was kind of the first time I got to talk with Joe. He's impressive. I mean, obviously, he's got his finger on the pulse of a lot. 200 additional projects that the city is carrying on their back as a result of Super Bowl. But that's a good thing, because once they leave, we're the beneficiary of the improvements that have been made. And I think most everyone in the business community and leadership positions and otherwise recognize and realize that if we go about this in the right way, we do it in a meaningful way, we do it in a deliberate way, we spend the dollars in an efficient way in order to accomplish and bring to an end some of these projects that we desire to get completed, there's not a negative connotation to any of that, is there? Something to think about. We'll be right back. We'll check in with Ian Hoke, who's in Scoot, when we return. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Ian Hoke joins us. He's in for Scoot, and he's got a great lineup coming your way. What's headed their way?
Good afternoon, Newell. We're going to talk to Jeff Asher from AH Datalytics about how 2024 was one of the least violent years in New Orleans going back a couple decades. We'll talk about how that happened and how we can keep the momentum going. In the 3 o'clock hour, some pretty alarming news about dementia risk. We're expected to see maybe 2 out of 5 U.S. adults over the age of 55 will develop some some symptoms of dementia. We'll talk to Dr. Patrick Porter about that. And I'm also going to see if we can find a little time to talk about video games. That's, you know, we often think that, oh, that's like a young person's thing. But no, new research shows that engagement with video games is now so widespread that your average baby boomer is more likely to be a gamer than not. So we'll talk about video games that you might enjoy or what you'd recommend to somebody just getting started. It's going to be a good one, Noel.
Absolutely. I am not in that number.
Not yet.
Stay tuned. Ian's headed your way.